How do the best data scientists in the world master their data sets, train their models, and climb the data science ladder? Let's ask them. My name's Jeremy, and this is the Towards Data Science podcast.
Institution you're coming from, you can get access to the very latest research.
We also have to make sure that we're constantly revisiting our foundations and justifying why we're using the methods we are.
At that time, I said, and I want people to hear this, that you have worth and you have skills, and there's someone who needs that somewhere.
Hello, Internet. Welcome to the Towards Data Science podcast. My name is Jeremy. I'm on the team over at the Sharpest Minds Data Science Mentorship Program. And today's episode is very special, not only because we'll be talking to Jeremy Howard, co-founder of Fast AI, but also because the topic of our conversation is going to be the very viral report that he and Rachel Thomas put out just a little bit over a week ago about the coronavirus outbreak. We'll be talking about the data that point to its rate of spread, death rate, and seasonality, among other things. So just really excited to jump into this extremely timely discussion. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us on such short notice.
Hello, other Jeremy with an IE. Nice to see you.
Well, it's great to have you. You've done all kinds of impressive things. That includes founding a number of successful startups, serving as the president and chief scientist at Kaggle. You founded Fast AI, which is, if anyone's not familiar with that, I think pretty well everyone listening to this podcast will be, but it delivers really what I think is the single best data science curriculum, sort of machine learning curriculum, to help with the modeling side that exists. I think on the internet, it's fair to say, I've certainly been recommending it a lot to people. So definitely something to check out. But today, we're actually going to be talking about something else entirely, and that's this report that you put together along with Rachel Thomas that presents a really rigorous sort of data-driven case for why we should be concerned about COVID-19, the coronavirus pandemic that we're all now experiencing together. What made you decide to write the report in the first place?
Well, you know, that report is decades old in COVID-19 years. It's we released it 10 days ago now. And, for a few weeks, we've been concerned. And we were concerned because we saw, you know, we're data scientists. And, so we're looking at the data. We saw this this epidemic that it was coming along out of China, where each person that was infected would infect somewhere between around 2 and 4 others, depending on the place.
This is that R-naught value.
This is R-naught, yeah. Or we can just call it R because R0's got its own things going on. So we'll just call it R. So, and the death rate varied a lot, you know, sometimes less than 1%, sometimes far more than that. So we just did some back of the envelope. Well, I don't use envelopes. I use Excel, but that's kind of uncool. So we'll pretend it was an envelope. And thought like, oh, this could be terribly, terribly bad. And at about that time, we saw China basically shut up shop.
Yeah.
And, you know, China's an interesting country because, I mean, they did some things that were less than ideal, to say the least, like arresting the whistleblowers who told them about this and censoring any mention of this on social media.
Suboptimal.
Suboptimal, but, you know, that's their way. But the other thing I'll say about their way is that their leadership is full of scientists and engineers. And when they decide to basically shut down their economy over at a point when there was like, what, 50 cases or something,
yeah.
Or, you know, in Wuhan, we thought, okay, they see it too. And they will have done a lot more than a quick Excel spreadsheet. And then we kind of look, and then we thought like, okay, well, what's this going to look like in the US, which, you know, as a Canadian, you're lucky enough not to know how incredibly bad our healthcare system is here. But it is, it's run for profit, which means there's no kind of fat in it. You know, there's no space to look after people in a pandemic. And also, you know, leadership at all levels here is not, does not come from the technical population. It largely comes from kind of lawyers and lobbyists and full-time politicians. So we were super worried that the response would be too little too late. And the biggest issue was, for, you know, however sick we all are of hearing about exponentials, you know, I taught for a number of years at Singularity University, which is basically all about looking at the impact of exponentials. And if there's one thing I know, it's no matter how much you talk about it, no matter how much you hear about it, you still underestimate exponentials. And indeed, Rachel and I even underestimated exponentials, you know. So we thought, okay, a couple of weeks ago, it's come, you know, it's we got to do something. What can we do? Well, at least we can inform our local community. So we jotted down some points that we thought our local community needed to know, because if we could inform our local community, at least that might help, you know, local schools to close and you know, people to stop getting together in groups and to wash their hands and all that. So we just jotted down some points. And my kind of view is always like, okay, if you're going to share, if you're going to go to the effort of writing something down, make it public, because then more people can read it if they want to. And then we would just like, oh my God, you know, 4 days later, 500,000 people have read this thing. And we're just like, oh shit, it turns out people, you know, are much more interested in our views about COVID-19 than deep learning, because nobody's, we've never had 500,000 people read a deep learning thing we've written.
It's a much more positive kind of virality in that case. Yeah,
I guess so. Yeah. And, you know, we heard from like a lot of doctors and hospitals and stuff saying, like, because it was shared a lot through WhatsApp and Nextdoor and Facebook and stuff like that. Like, and so we kept on hearing from people saying, you know, oh, like three different people have told me to read this, like doctors would say this. And like, and I, you know, so I finally read it. And then we took it to our hospital leadership and we decided to, you know, totally reorient our clinic. And so like we heard from a lot of people who significantly changed the behavior of themselves and their organizations, which is good.
Well, and you alluded in your answer to, you mentioned this idea that, you know, we're sick and tired at this point of hearing exponential growth. And it's almost like there's a sense in which this crisis has created a sharp division between people who have some kind of intuition for exponentials and people who don't. What would you say are some of the key ways and the most important ways in which exponential growth has really thrown off a lot of people's intuitions on this one?
Well, human intuition doesn't work exponentially. Like, we just don't get exponentials intuitively. So the big thing for me in trying to think about this for myself and my family is to try to like totally ignore my intuition and just look at the data and then do some scenario analysis. So so it's been interesting to see how many people have expressed surprise at like what's happening in Italy even now, where else, you know. And like I was telling my local community a couple of weeks ago, you know, all the schools are going to be closed in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And you better start planning. And like San Francisco will not be able to keep going as it is, because like at that point it was already obvious we were one of the earlier places in the US for cases. And so we started thinking about, you know, we started planning on the assumption that, okay, this city is going to shut down. You know, our daughter won't be able to go to school. But it felt wrong.
Yeah.
You know, but nobody else was doing it. Nothing was happening. You couldn't see anything. And so like now is not the time to start using our intuition. Now is the time to keep doing that like scenario planning. So what's going to happen next? Well, we're going to have, you know, there's this group called the Super Forecasters, who are people in forecasting competitions who have been the best at forecasting over the last 4 years. They're saying there's going to be somewhere around 1 to 10 million deaths. So, and you remember,
and sorry, does that assume interventions or?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is after assuming like, okay, once you have 10,000 deaths or whatever, people will freak out and do everything possible. But even after, you know, so, there's going to be enough deaths that, things that seem like extreme reactions right now are going to get much, much worse. And so I still hear people saying like, oh, our school is closed for 3 weeks. What are we going to do for the next 3 weeks? And just like, oh, come on. Yeah, what, how is it going to open in 3 weeks? Like, in 3 weeks' time, there will be, you know, what is that? 2, 4, 8, 16, you know, times more. I shouldn't say more cases that have been tested positive. And people will be freaking out a lot more. They're not going to start opening the schools.
Well, and actually, you're distinguishing there between two things that I think often get conflated, especially in the media, and that's confirmed cases, yeah. tested cases, yeah. and yeah. sort of silent, not necessarily even asymptomatic, but just unconfirmed cases.
Right.
And there's a big delta between those two, right?
Right. I mean, orders of magnitude. So the modeling I saw from a week or so ago was there might be about 50,000 cases in the U.S., real cases. 50% of cases tend to be asymptomatic. But what we're really seeing clearly is that even asymptomatic cases, even young people, they're spreaders.
Yeah.
Right? So we shouldn't be thinking how many people are there, you know, with a fever and a cough, but how many people are there with the illness. And in one region of Italy, just a region of 3,000 people, they just said, okay, fuck it. Let's see this. Let's see what's actually happening. Let's test everybody. And they tested everybody. They found 55 people, I think, with the illness. They quarantined them all and they stopped it in its tracks. Right. So like, when you realize that, it's not just that, you know, it's the people who remain asymptomatic, but also people who are continuing to spread before they get symptoms. So it's like there's this zombie army walking around like zombifying people without you knowing. And then 4 days later, you know, or more, it's like more like a week or two later, it's like, holy shit, it turns out I was a zombie the whole time. So, you know, the idea that we are still only testing people that are known to have been in contact with somebody else with the disease, when we know that like far less than 1/10 of the people with the disease actually are known to have it, and we only do it when they have symptoms, it's the very definition of like suicidal insanity.
To some degree, to put numbers to that, I remember when the first case came out in Seattle and there was a study that was done to show that this thing had been circulating based on their genetic analysis for something like 6 weeks, which is about, depending on how you parse it, about 10 doubling times. That's like 4,000 cases. So it's like by the time you've detected the first case, there are, I mean, the human intuition just rebels against this, but there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of others out there. Right.
The other thing that the human intuition rebels against is the idea that epidemiologists are saying 30 to 70% of people in the world will get infected, right? And the natural reaction to that is like, come on. But then it's like, okay, it's not so weird. Like, there are other coronaviruses, such as the one that frequently causes the cold.
Yeah.
You know, the common cold, which we all get 2 to 4 times on average a year. So like, is it so weird that this coronavirus could basically infect everybody on the planet, more or less? Not weird at all. It's like, that's just business as usual for coronavirus.
With no natural immunity too, presumably. So we start off with a real deficit in terms of our ability to fight off the early infection.
Yeah, and then like, think about the long term here. Like, we don't have a track record of stopping flu viruses or coronavirus.
Yeah.
Like, they're still around. We don't like them much. They're a huge cost to the economy. You know, presumably, hopefully, this will get more investment in vaccines than the common cold. But like, we shouldn't assume we're just going to be able to knock it over, because it's not been easy for the past couple of hundred years of dealing with colds and flus.
And I guess this one is different materially from those in terms of the death rate. This is something that people have struggled with estimating. You alluded to it. I mean, we don't even have a particularly clear estimate on it. What are some of the reasons why things have been so ambiguous on that side of things?
Well, one of the problems is people simplify the math too much. So people tend to say like, okay, how many people are dead now? And how many confirmed cases are there now? And then they divide one by the other and they say, oh, that's the death rate.
Yeah.
Which, you know, generally will get you 0.5, 0.6, 0.7%. Another misunderstanding of exponential growth. So actually, if you look at like when all this is going around, the number of cases in South Korea, which is where a lot of people were saying like, oh, the death rate's fine. We just did this ratio in South Korea. 98% of cases in South Korea were unresolved. So they were saying, let's take 100% of the people that are dead, you know, on the top, and the entire group of people, including those who have not yet recovered or died on the bottom, and assume that's a death rate. It's obviously like mathematically stupid. But look, you know, this is not that hard. There's a thing called survival analysis, which everybody is forced to sit through when they study probability and statistics. But, you know, it's a technique that's been around for a very long time where we can deal with censored data. So censored data is data where we don't know the result yet. It's used for life insurance. It's used for marketing campaigns. You know, this person in the funnel has not yet converted to a customer, but they also haven't walked away. It's not like, oh, we can't take a ratio, therefore this is so complex we can't know what to do. It's like, yes, we can, right? And epidemiologists do. And the last two reports I've seen have had a death rate of 1.4 or 1.6%. So, they're not wildly all over the place. But the other thing to note is the death rate varies hugely depending on intervention. You know, the current modeling suggests that hospitals in the UK, for instance, are going to be like they'll have about 1/10 of the capacity that's required. And we know that a super high percentage of people need critical hospital care.
Yeah.
So this is why it looks like in the UK, the death rate could be way higher. And indeed in Italy, I think it's, you know, even the simple ratio is like 8% at the moment.
Yeah, resolved cases in Italy, it's absolutely terrifying from what I've seen, something even close to 50%, if I recall. Now, of course, that could easily be in large part because of a failure to screen and they're missing a lot of asymptomatic cases, but still.
Yeah, I mean, all these ratios don't quite work, but, it's 8% on the low side, 50% on the high side. I haven't done the survival analysis because it's obviously high enough to be terrifying. But, you know, the other thing is, in the 1918 flu epidemic, the first season wasn't even the bad one.
Right, yeah.
You know, it wasn't until year two that shit really hit the fan. You know, year one, they were thinking, like, this is bad. And then year two, it was like, oh, that wasn't bad at all.
That's redefined bad.
We might see the same thing.
And that, I think, is somewhat related to another topic that you touched on in the report, and I've seen you tweet about more recently. And that's this idea of seasonality that we might have, as some have hypothesized, this like summer respite. What's your sense of the plausibility of that, and then what impact that might have on the possibility of a second bump then in the incidence?
Very plausible. And I say that with full awareness that there are complex, nuanced public policy implications here. If we start saying, you know, the takeaway is not, hey, if you're in a warm climate, you're fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, look at the flu, right? There are hot, humid countries. So let's start with, there's a paper that says hotter, more humid climates have less transmission. There's some terrible visualization in that paper that has caused people to fail to read it and assume it's terrible paper.
Actually, can you describe that visualization for a sec? Because you tweeted about it, and I think there are lessons in there for people who...
Sure. So, you know, it's great data science lessons and great data scientific communication lessons. The paper... I mean, first of all, let's give credit where it's due. The paper came from a bunch of Chinese researchers, and so many Chinese researchers have been writing papers in English,
yeah,
and submitting them to Western journals, like the original Lancet paper that, you know, got us started back in January, I think, was just such a thing. Which is like, that is super cool, because I bet if it had come out of, you know, Kentucky or San Francisco or Montreal, we wouldn't have been writing Chinese papers and putting them into, you know, Beijing journals. So a bunch of Chinese researchers went to the trouble of writing an English language paper. They did some pretty heroic analysis. In China, they did massive contact tracing to figure out, you know, who's everybody you've seen if you're infected and who have they seen, and, you know, just a huge countrywide effort. They took that data in 100 cities and created chains of 105 contacts, you know, like it's like amazing work. And then they studied that to see like what was the actual transmission rates going on. They did a panel regression. And then unfortunately, they drew a chart that on the x-axis showed for each of 100 cities, the temperature, and on the y-axis, the transmission rate based on that analysis. And not surprisingly, it's just a blob of dots. And then even worse, they drew through it. And so people without reading the paper basically went like, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You can't. You know, this is not, you know, it's basically just some outliers that are pushing this line up or down. There's no relationship there. So that was a scientific communication fail. But they did actually do something much more sensible, which is a proper mixed effects panel regression, including confounding factors, which was density, population density, and GDP per capita. And when you include, the full model with those four factors, and they also very sensibly included a version in which they removed Wuhan, because Wuhan, they basically had a weird data thing where they kind of they changed their criteria, and so they looked like the whole lot of cases appeared at once. And with p less than 0.01, temperature and humidity, there's clearly a relationship. Statistical significance to me is meaningless. More importantly, there's a practically significant relationship there, which is so big that the difference between R in Tokyo now versus R in Tokyo in August is 2 versus 1. You know, so the difference between like something that's continually doubling versus something that doesn't even grow. So that does suggest that in parts of, you know, well, pretty much most of the US does get warm in summer. So we may well see things settle down, which is quite likely to lead to a whole lot of people going, oh, well, that was a big nothing burger.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Why did we shut down this economy for no reason? Then there might not be any investment in face masks or in testing kits or in ventilators. And then when winter hits, you know, it's going to be like 1918 all over again.
And this, I guess, assumes that the first wave doesn't already get us to the point where we have hopefully something like herd immunity, but like, you know, 85%. And incidentally, I'm not saying hopefully we get to that point,
right,
which is,
well, just to be clear, we'll know if we get to that point, because if 70% of people are infected, then we will have had those 1 to 10 million deaths. That's how we get herd immunity, right? Is by, you know, is if it's within a year, it's shitloads of people dying because nobody can go to hospital because they're full, because we, you know, things spiraled out of control.
And this is sort of the principle behind shifting the curve that people have been talking about, flattening the curve, I should say. In other words, ensuring that at no point, or as much as possible, at no point would the medical system be overwhelmed. One of the things I've seen on this note, though, that I find a little concerning is when people actually put numbers on the y-axis in terms of shifting the curve, and they look at the actual numbers that would be coming into hospital, would be needing ventilators any moment in time, and then compare that to the actual capacity of the healthcare system, even being optimistic, you end up seeing that the influx just wildly overshoots anything, like it's orders of magnitude beyond what the system can accommodate.
In the UK, that's definitely true. So like the UK just seems so screwed. And it's because of this extraordinary apathy and hubris from the UK government, you know, rather than looking at the massive amount of work and expertise coming out of China and South Korea and Taiwan and so forth, and learning from that for months, they relied on a secret private English university analysis of a completely different disease, which, so they just got it totally wrong, you know, because some kind of not invented here syndrome combined with racism, combined with a, you know, deep belief in the, you know, importance of listening to the right kinds of people or something. So that's terrifying. It's not as clear in the US. You know, the US is a big place. We have a huge shortage of hospital beds, full stop. We have a really inefficient medical system.
Well, isn't it fair to say, though, that most countries have, like, because we're talking about something here that's going to slam the median medical system, even world-class countries that have really invested in this stuff. It's like orders of magnitude beyond anything right. that these systems have encountered. Right.
So Italy, Northern Italy has, you know, under most metrics, a better hospital system than the US. They have more, pretty much everybody has more beds per capita than we do.
Right.
They're already slammed, and it's still early days.
I guess this is where I kind of find myself oscillating between, like, of course, flattening the curve is key, if only because it'll cause us to save like twice as many lives, or, you know, however many the kind of the overlap between the healthcare system's capacity and the actual curve itself ends up being.
Yeah, probably a lot more than 2x. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which is hugely significant. But in terms of saving the bulk of people, I imagine something like we're almost relying at that point on a treatment or a...
No, we're not. What we have to do, I mean, you're right about the issue, right? We can't shut down the global economy for years. But here's the good news. Some countries have already figured this out. Some countries have got this under control without a lockdown. Here's the bad news. Here's the bad news. Those countries are in Asia, and we don't listen to them. So we're going to have to, like, swallow our pride and accept that maybe it's worth listening to Asians sometimes, right? South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore have done this. You know, maybe Singapore, it's a hot, humid climate, but, you know, everybody's in air-conditioned places there all the time anyway. So, but certainly like South Korea. So how have they done that? Testing everywhere, face masks on everyone, fantastic contact tracing, and then, you know, rigorous quarantining of people who are affected. So, like, why lock down everybody if you're not sick? Like, when I say if you're not sick, if you're not infected, that's just a waste of time. The cost of a test in terms of the materials and time is like a couple of bucks. You know, obviously in the US they charge you thousands because that's our healthcare system. But the, you know, it should be a couple of bucks. It's a nasal swab. It's not rocket science. I mean, it has to go further up the nose than anyone would want to do to themselves. But it's, you know, it's something you could teach someone in a day or two of training, and then a bit of chemicals. Again, not expensive or weird chemicals. And so South Korea had drive-by testing everywhere. And so they didn't lock up everybody. They just locked up the sick people. And so their economy's continuing. And they don't have this thing about masks either.
Right, you know, yes.
In South Korea, if you're not wearing a mask, that's really antisocial, because you're basically saying, for my comfort, I am going to risk infecting you. So you better damn well wear a mask, because otherwise, you know, you're putting people's lives at risk for your convenience and comfort. Or else, you know, in parts of the US and Europe, I people keep saying, like, I tried to wear a mask, and just people keep coming up to me and hassling me.
Yeah.
And saying, you don't need it. Because literally the Surgeon General came out and said, you don't need it, which is absolute bullshit. Like, there is no evidence at all that you don't need it.
Well, this to me was one of the most defining moments where we in a way kind of realized where governments, at least in the West, had decided to double down. They had the choice between being honest and admitting, look, right, we right. failed to prepare for this catastrophically. People right. are going to die because of our incompetence. Or just saying, oh no, that's okay, we didn't fail to prepare because masks are useless anyway.
Right. I mean, we were already in a low trust environment, which is very damaging to democracy. We're now in a zero trust environment. Like, when you can't trust the CDC, Who the hell can you trust? And yeah, I mean, they're all doing it. They're all saying you don't need masks. Oh, unless you're a doctor, and then you really need them.
For some reason.
How stupid do you think we are?
Yeah.
You know, if they need them, we need them too.
Well, remarkably, though, I mean, there were certainly a lot of people I saw on social media, obviously, you see a lot of people saying, hey, you know, listen to your healthcare authorities. And there's a sense in which, I mean, when you go down the list of things we've been told, it's like there's no asymptomatic spread. It's not a big deal. This thing isn't a pandemic. You just go down the list and it's just like one thing after another. It's no wonder people weren't stocking up in time.
Well, the thing I hate about this is like, these are all the messages I don't want to be giving people. I don't want to be saying to people, don't trust the government, don't trust the CDC, don't trust, you know, I mean, this is conspiracy theorist wacko stuff, you know? I mean, and we know that that's a path to a kind of deterioration of democracy. But they're very clearly lying to us. And it's like, and it's for their convenience because they could just go out and say, government order, all masks until X million go to healthcare workers, but they don't feel they can do that while still appealing to their base. So instead, they come out and say, you don't need them. Or they could say, okay, we have decided to, you know, again, government fiat, or they could just do it with economics. They could order, like China ordered 38 million masks right at the start of this, which is another reason there are no masks go around. So if the government did that now, they said, okay, now we want 38 million masks. See how many entrepreneurs start figuring out how to build masks.
Right.
Especially if they say like, hey, you know, testing requirements are going to be much more limited. You know, they don't have to be perfect. One of our community members in the Fast AI community has actually shared information about how to create homemade masks based on her experience in Southeast Asia during SARS, where, you know, they've already done this. Again, like, so all of her links and information were all from Chinese native sources. So there's a lot of information out there, but we're going to have to get out of our, you know, Western-centric bubble to see it.
And I guess bold action is a part of this too, because when we're in this environment, this kind of low information environment, the certainly the Western bias at this point has been to say, almost like, well, you know, let's wait and see how it is once it hits us, rather than saying, oh, there's ambiguity and part of the long tail has us in like serious national crisis territory.
Well, this is where we want to use kind of Bayesian probabilistic programming, right? And this is one of the big disasters from the Imperial College modeling that got everything so wrong and set the UK in the wrong direction. They just did this kind of a point estimate. And when you do a point estimate rather than a you know, this is the range of values it could be based on the data that we have available, you realize that if the actual spread or death rate is higher than you guessed, because of the exponential growth and the amount of time it takes to realize it's happened, it's too late and you're killing millions of people, that's really bad. Versus closing schools a week early, it's like, you know, it's, I mean, closing schools is itself a challenging, tricky, nuanced subject, but at least like closing the pubs.
Yeah.
You know, that why not do that first?
Yeah.
See if you can get things controlled, you know, cancel all events over 10 people, all that kind of stuff. But man, they just dragged their tail. Because they weren't doing the confidence intervals and the simulations that would have told them, hey, there's a, you know, 48% chance that a million people will die, then they might have reacted very differently.
It's sort of tough, I guess, when it's all numbers on a spreadsheet. I'm just remembering my girlfriend went out to do groceries about a week ago, and like she was wearing a mask when she did it. And like the looks she was getting, hopefully this is going to actually start to change things, I guess, around practices involving mask wearing.
You know, this is, and I say this kind of with, in a teasing way, there's this kind of like guy I considered like crazy prepper dude, John Stokes, who I think he like founded Ars Technica or something, who's got this like prepper website. And I saw on Twitter, he was saying like, man, this is such a low trust environment that the best information I've ever found on this virus came from some AI startup.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, dude, John's talking about me.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit, man. Suddenly I'm like the crazy prepper dude. And we're doing it. Like, we're disinfecting every package that comes in. We have been for weeks. We're, you know, practicing all these like crazy sanitation PPE procedures. And then like, I was like, who's this John Stokes guy? And I went to his website and there's all these ads for like, you know, best escape survival backpacks and whatever. Like, what is this place? And I looked through all their recommendations and I'm like, I said to Rachel, we're doing all of these things. We've joined the crazy prepper community.
Well, I've heard it said of these, of the so-called crazy preppers, they only have to be right once. And this is their time.
This is their time. I'm with them. I am officially a crazy prepper.
Well, it's funny though, because, and again, you can call it crazy prepper, you can call it somebody who has an intuition for exponentials. You were saying Twitter's where people are getting all the best information to some degree if they're following the right accounts. It's funny because tech Twitter does seem to have hit this one on the head in some cases as early as like mid-January, early January even. What do you think it is about tech Twitter that was where people were so far ahead of this?
Yeah, well, it's also startup Twitter. It's kind of like, you know, people who are more comfortable, you know, doing things like, I don't know, writing a check or changing their life to focus on building something that doesn't exist yet, you know. And so I've done that lots of times in my life. And every time I have, everybody's, you know, my friends and family, they've always, in nice ways, kind of told me I'm crazy. So there's something very weird about putting your life behind something that doesn't exist, nobody's buying, nobody wants, just because you can tell that, you know, in 12 months' time, people will want to if you give them this thing in this way. So there's a bit of that. You know, I think techies are also like building things a lot. They're more data-driven folks, but there's plenty of techies that are also still way down in the ludicrous head in the sand end, you know. I mean, obviously Elon Musk is just had his head so far in the sand, it's, I don't know, like what he's looking at down there. It's like, I think also it's like, I don't know, to some extent people have to believe what they want to believe, you know. So if you're a billionaire CEO whose all of his potential future earnings come from vesting shares that have very specific financial performance requirements, like Elon Musk, say, you have very good reason to want to think this is a nothing burger.
Well, do you think on the, because when we talk about the startup side, one thing that comes to mind too is like a lot of these people, startups are, the language of exponential growth is just pervasive, right? I mean, you're constantly talking about month over month percentage growth and so right. on. I mean, do you think that has something to do with it? I often wonder if that's part of what's caused people to go, oh, wow, like, you know, I've seen our values before that are big and I know what those mean, you know?
I still wouldn't overestimate how much like tech folks actually get it. Like, none of the startups I know of were actually changing their behavior in a way that recognized there was a pandemic coming. Like, you know, all of the schools I know of in the Bay Area stayed open way longer than they should have, you know, even the very well-off one, private schools that absolutely could have. All of the tech conferences, like,
right.
Still, you know, 2 weeks ago, they still all thought they were on. And I was just like, how can anybody yeah. think that there's going to be a conference? I mean, I think there was a big difference between like a small group of kind of tech Twitter who were saying like this is extremely worrying versus the actual behavior of nearly everybody, which clearly thought life was going to continue as usual.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of selection bias in my Twitter feed nowadays, especially because of this. But actually, on that note, so the I think one of the really interesting things about this, we live in a unique time because of the exponential nature of this, where a select few people have been able to pull off time after time predictions that seem insane today, but they're almost, you can almost be 100% sure they're going to be true tomorrow. Things like when you're citing, you know, we will be in the tens of thousands of cases in the US within a couple weeks. And people might hear that and say, that's like impossible. On the flip side, I saw an interesting post that argued, you know, you're going to be amazed at how quickly things are going to return to normal. Not that they're going to return normal soon, but if we get an uncontrolled, you know, peak and things hit, you know, 30 to 70% infection rates, all of a sudden the drop off on the other side of that could be alarmingly fast. Do you buy into that or do you disagree?
Oh, sure. I mean, like, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you watch movies, but in The Last Avengers, like the setting of it was just after half of the people in the universe were killed. And then they kind of, and so then they kind of skipped to a few years in the future. And there's like comedians on TV having joking around about, you know, the results of that happening and like kids doing their school essays about this historical event or whatever. I mean, I think, you know, I think that's life, right? For sure. But, I mean, we would much rather, you know, we would much rather that we didn't watch our grandparents suffocate to death, literally, you know, like, I mean, I know you're not saying that's okay. I'm just saying, yeah. Like, you know, the world moves on, but we would prefer it was without the huge suffering of our loved ones in our community.
I guess I meant more the mathematical impact in the sense that the curve is going to be sharp on the way up and in a way sharp on the way down potentially. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's not checked at least, and it would be great if it were.
The sharper the way up is, the sharper the way down will be, because it's just like, okay, everybody's now infected. The people are going to die. They're all dead. Okay, let's move on. That's herd immunity.
Yeah.
The version where we do like contact tracing and testing and like the rigorous approach where we don't shut down our economy, that's the version that actually could last for years. But even in the case of the herd immunity approach, that could last for years as well, because there's strong signs that this is another of these highly mutating viruses. So it seems likely that COVID-19 is going to be part of life, I don't know, for the next few years.
Hopefully that motivates a lot of technological developments too. But I guess we'll have to see. Well, thanks so much for making the time, Jeremy. I really appreciate it. I almost don't need to tell people to check out Fast AI and Jeremy Howard, check you out on Twitter. But can you just share your Twitter handle just for people who want to go straight to it?
Yeah, sure thing. It's Jeremy P. Howard.
Awesome. So we'll include that link in the blog post that will accompany this podcast. Thanks so much, Jeremy. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.